The Eagles turned back to survival mode on opening night. How the defending champs got it done again in a game full of yellow flags on the field and red flags for that Falcons offense. Plus, we're going to break down the biggest matchups of Sunday, including the new-look Bears offense versus the new-look Packers D, and the Cowboys try to grind it out against Kuechly and Carolina. It's all on a special opening night edition of the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast, the opening night special edition. We just got through Falcons-Eagles here. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We're going to talk about this game a little bit. We're also going to preview the headlining games of week one. But Andy, kind of like last year, a lot like last year's win over the Falcons last January. And then we saw Nick Foles become, the new Carson Wentz for 2 weeks, and now it was sort of back to survival mode for the Eagles here.
Yeah, and you wonder, maybe it's just the way these teams match up against each other. Two slugfest games in a row now that have come down to red zone play, primarily with Atlanta's offense versus Philly's defense. I thought it was a really well-played game defensively, and I thought both offenses looked, let's call it, sluggish. I mean, a variety of ways they look sluggish.
Yeah, let's start on the Eagles side here. Look, it was an especially slow start for them. Anyone who watched this game, Falcons mounted a couple of drives to start. Eagles really didn't get anything going until the second quarter. They control the clock, and this is a point I wanted to make in this game here. You'll look at the time of possession stats and say, well, Philly 32 minutes. That's not a huge advantage here, but they didn't have the ball much in the first quarter. They had a 14 play drive in the second quarter, an 11 play drive in the third. They had the ball 8 for 54 on that game winning drive. A human night like that, it's almost like the analogy I'll give that no one will get because you're all football fans and not baseball fans, is the new thing in baseball is high stress innings for a pitcher. It's not the total number of pitches he throws that you're looking at. If he throws an inning where he has 30 pitches, that's when you're gonna
setting off
the alarms.
Like that.
Then you wanna bring it out. So it's like with Atlanta, it's one thing to be out there for a couple of 4-play drives, 5-play drives, 6-play or whatever. When you're out there for the long ones and that it kind of ruins you for the rest of the night.
Well, and that's a great point that it's coming in stretches like that, because I think Philadelphia, it looks like they ran 64 plays in the game, and it felt like that watching the game. It didn't. Yeah. They didn't go hurry. A lot of times these teams that run a bunch of plays, it's because they go hurry up too, and you get a lot of plays crammed into less time. When you keep the defense on the field, especially in week one where these guys are acclimating, no matter how big, no matter who they are, what they've done all summer, they're still acclimating. Defenders are reactionary. It's harder to exert as a reactionary mover than a proactive mover. That's going to favor the offense every time. And I would imagine we're going to see a lot of teams in these games on Sunday, Gary, keep that in mind. And the NFL is about explosive plays ultimately. And Atlanta didn't have enough tonight. They didn't have enough last season. And that apparently remains a concern. But in week one, more than any other week, mounting long drives takes on an added significance.
Yeah, well, let's talk about how the Eagles did it. And let's start with the two touchdown runs for Jay Ajayi. They were both unique formations here. There was the short one, the first touchdown of the game, where it was an unbalanced line with Zach Ertz on one side. And they ended up running to that side. The second one was a six-man line. And again, they went to, I would call that the short side. I guess it's technically not the weak side. But there's less big dudes over there. So I'll call it the side you wouldn't expect the play to go to necessarily. But why did this stuff work tonight, Andy?
Well, let's start with that second one, first of all, and it went unnoticed on the broadcast because there's so much going on that play. Zach Ertz tight end blocked Derek Shelby, the defensive end, one-on-one. And it was a reach block, and then he sealed him back inside. It wasn't pretty, but it was highly effective, and it's what made the touchdown work. And that's the best you can ever hope for from any tight end. It was a great – it was Ertz's best play of the night by far, and he had a kind of an up-and-down night the rest of the game. So that was the big one there. Peters flashed on the play, and Jason Kelce's mobility, we know how important that is for what Philly does. So that was a good emblematic Eagles run on that play. And then the other one, the first touchdown, the shorter one, what teams do on defense often when you see an unbalanced line, and by unbalanced we mean, I think in this case, was I want to say it was a guard, I think it's maybe left tackle Peters, someone, one, either the guard or tackle from the left side went over to the right side, so the tight end was technically now the new offensive tackle on the left side. When you see that, that's the unbalanced O-line, a lot of teams will just pretend that the right guard is now the center, and everything stays balanced from the defense's perspective when you do that. So they line up off of the players rather than in relation to the ball. Not all the Falcons were on the same page with that against that unbalanced O-line. That's why you go unbalanced O-line. You want to get guys defensively on different pages. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened.
Well, let's talk about, you know, no Alshon Jeffrey in this one. I know you're not a huge Alshon Jeffrey guy, but this really was the Eagles grinding it out against a defense that matches up well against them. And last year, the elements worked against them a little bit. That wasn't as much of a factor tonight. I know it was hot and humid down in Philadelphia, but gosh, they stayed on the field. They did some more neat stuff with the RPOs.
Yep, they absolutely did. And one thing I really liked off of those RPOs, and Collinsworth on NBC did a tremendous job putting it in very simple, easy to digest and process terms, which is run blocks on the left side. In this game, is on the left side, the run blocks. On the right side, pass blocks. And there's basically two plays split right down the middle there. Those run blocks the Eagles employed, they had zone blocks and man-to-man or gap scheme blocks in them. So not only are they running RPOs, but they're doing them off of expansive zone, different run looks, different zone and man run looks. And that really is the Eagles' offense in a nutshell. Their running game and the stuff they do with their three interior offensive linemen, Wisniewski, Brooks at guard, and then, of course, Kelce at center, that's the backbone of this offense. And to expand that into the RPO game is going to be big for them, because what you mentioned about Alshon Jeffrey out, now Mac Hollins is out for the season, even when Jeffrey's back, but especially while he's gone, this receiving corps doesn't scare anyone. And Atlanta's corners, even in zone coverage, matched up as if it were man at times, because they just were not at all threatened by the Eagles' wideouts out wide. So the Eagles are going to have to manipulate teams inside and win through scheme, and it starts with how they use those interior linemen in their RPOs and their run game.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Eagles had some neat moments in this game. It was nice. It kind of called back to last year, and this was a gutsy win. They had the Philly special 2.0 for a key third down there. Darren Sproles made one of the plays of the game, escaping Vic Beasley on that third down conversion. Yep. on the game winning drive there. They just kind of they made the plays that they had to make. And I know that sounds very cliche, and it kind of is, but you know, they had two turnovers. They were fairly fluky turnovers. They had the dude stepped on the live ball on the punt, and they had the ball that hit Dallas Goedert in the chest and popped up when he got hit. Not that Nick Foles didn't put a couple passes in danger, but you know, they overcame these things.
Yeah.
The Falcons did not. And this boy,
Goddard should have made that catch, by the way.
Goddard
should have
made that.
Caught that ball. That was a great play, though, by Kazee, DeMonte Kazee.
It was. Kazee didn't really, not that I want to get bogged down in this play, but Kazee didn't really put anything on the ball. I mean, it was just kind of like.
Oh, Foles? Yeah.
Yeah.
Foles didn't have a lot of.
Not Foles. No, no, I mean, Kazee didn't, like, there was no contact between, like, hand and ball, like it popped up.
Oh, I got you.
Or a helmet getting on the ball or something that would have violently jarred the ball loose. That's just kind of.
You know why? Yeah, I thought you were talking about Foles and his velocity on the throw, which also wasn't, you know, Foles is not a Roger Clemens type of quarterback.
Yeah.
And so I think the combination of the ball kind of taking some time to travel there, it was an over route or a post kind of over route where Goddard started on the right and the route went to the left, so he had to cross the formation. So a slow-developing route, the ball didn't have a lot of juice, and Kazee came screaming in. And I haven't played receiver, Gary. I guess I played tight end 1 year in junior high, so now I'm humiliated. Why did I even bring that up? But I would imagine if you're tracking a slow-moving ball and a defender comes from behind you at extra speed, I bet that's got a discombobulating feel to it, and I bet that's a big reason why Goddard didn't catch that ball. The contrast of speeds and everything that's happening in his peripheral visions, I bet, was very disruptive.
Yeah, it could be, and sometimes a high-velocity throw just kind of embeds itself into you. But
how worried are we about Atlanta's offense?
I don't want to go nuts on this because, look, it's week one. Clearly, there were some chemistry issues with Julio and Matt Ryan on a couple of these plays, which, I mean, look, they've both been playing for, I don't know, what, 40 years together at this point. So that's a little bit concerning, but I don't think that's a long-term issue. I guess the thing I was most concerned with was Matt Ryan was consistently, even when the timing wasn't off, his ball placement was just bad all night. You know, the long throw to Julio, which, again, I don't want to be the biggest Sarkisian apologist. He still has some work to do here, but that deep shot to Julio, that's a touchdown. Julio maybe should have still caught it, but Ryan throws over the wrong shoulder. What did you think of the play, the interception, the Rasul Douglas interception down near the goal line?
My sense was that initially I thought Ryan just didn't get enough juice on it because he was under, I think it was a zero blitz. And so zero blitz means it's one-on-one coverage everywhere. Nobody has any help. It also means that there's one more pass rusher than the offense can block. Philadelphia, and I'm 99% sure it was zero blitz, they do that every game about two or three times. And the hard part is you don't know when their coordinator, Jim Schwartz, is going to do it. He'll do it anywhere on the field on any down and distance. And a lot of teams do it on third down red zone type deals. That was a far red zone play. So I thought Ryan under the duress threw off his back foot and was short on it, but he knows it's zero blitz, so he's going one-on-one to Julio. Right play, wrong execution. But after watching it again and then seeing those two, Ryan and Jones, interact on the sideline, I think there was miscommunication on the play. I don't think Julio was exactly where Ryan thought he would be, and I don't know. We don't know whose fault that is.
Yeah. Yeah. It looked like Julio didn't think the ball was coming his way in any way, shape, or form, and it looked like Ryan only had eyes on Julio because you got your backup cornerback out there, and that's who he wanted to pick on.
Right, well, and he has to do that, too, because if he knows it's zero blitz, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say he read it, he's got to pick his matchup right away because, again, there's an unblocked defender guaranteed to come at him.
Yeah.
But Gary, Julio Jones had like 150 yards in this game. Are you worried about the chemistry of Ryan? And what about Calvin Ridley, Mohamed Sanu? Sanu had the big 3rd-and-8 conversion, but that was the only really time we heard from him all game. I don't think Atlanta's ball distribution was great. Their offense was not rhythmic again. And then the real concern, they were a downfield play-action offense tonight, and they didn't have any explosive plays. And that's a bad combination. You're downfield play-action. That's the whole point of that's getting 20-plus yard completions. They had the one that Jones should have caught. That I know you don't think it was a great throw. I understand that, but I'm a little uneasy about Atlanta's offense right now.
Well, and that's the thing. We've been uneasy for a year and a game now. So
yeah.
I'm a little bit concerned with Matt Ryan's performance tonight as a thrower. I thought the throw before, Deion Jones got the tip ball interception. They came back out and Ryan made a nice throw as he was absorbing a hit to get it to Julio to set up what was the Tevin Coleman touchdown run there. That was encouraging. That was the most encouraging thing I saw from Matt Ryan tonight. I felt. But again, this team in the red zone. I mean, it's brutal. The last four plays of this game, and also the first sequence of the first drive of the game. And all right, let's start at the beginning. Let's start with what went down, and that they went four plays and came up empty down there. Julio Jones is on the sideline. I guess I just wonder, Julio's gassed. He has to come out. Don't you just use a timeout at some point? Don't you want to, like, get him back on the field?
Interesting theory. They went heavy personnel on that. They featured their fullback a lot in the first half. They went fullback and extra tight ends, and Philly out-executed them. It didn't work. And I think any coach would tell you, our offense, we believe, we aspire to have an offense that's going to get the ball in the end zone and out of goal line situations. That's football 101. That's what you do your first day of high school football practice growing up. And the defense feels the same way, though, and they want to win those matchups too. So I don't know if I'd get overly concerned about their goal line. And you know, we can discuss the play calling, which is kind of what you're getting into, I guess. I thought the last four plays were interesting, the sequence. For one, they went spread empty formation on three of those, the last three, which they had not done all game, I don't think. Which was fine, but the first two were kind of ISIL route feels, and there was undefined throws and nothing to really stress the defense. I mean, there was nothing to punish the Eagles for dedicating a double on Julio Jones, and you've got to assume Julio's going to get doubled there. And he was doubled from the inside slot, the nearest slot, which is the hardest place on a football field. Bill Belichick believes this. It's the hardest place to double team a wide receiver. The double team worked because it was just Jones running to the goalpost, and they didn't have anything built off of that. The last play, they did do a nice job. They had a stack release, Jones and Sanu, and they got the double off of Jones. In fact, the double wound up plastering to Sanu, and Jones came open, or not open, but he got one-on-one against Darby. Yeah. And then from there, Darby won the matchup, and Ryan was under some duress. So the last play was well-schemed, just defense executed better. Those first few, though, were not very well-schemed.
Yeah. I mean, it just felt like a series of spread it out, and we're gonna lob it toward the goalpost. And even the one where they got the extra play on the illegal contact, I guess you would call Austin Hooper the intended receiver on that play, but it was the same thing. It was just sort of a jump ball at the back of the end zone, which, I mean, they were like nine yards out.
Right. No, that probably should have been the last. I didn't think that was I thought that was a little bit of a ticky-tack call. And I know you call it the same every play, but given the situation too, I thought that was a tad ticky-tack. So, no, I'm with you. Atlanta has some work to do, and maybe we'll feel differently when we see them on film. But there was not a lot of rhythm to their offense in this game tonight.
Yeah. I got to be honest. I'm a little bit worried about Matt Ryan. Little bit.
Yeah, I hear that. I'm a few blocks behind you on that journey.
Yeah,
I'm more than a few blocks. I'm not. I guess I'm not worried yet.
I was gonna say, in that you're not worried at all. Just couple random observations. A ton of penalties in this game. A lot of penalties. My guy from Yale got two penalties on special teams in the first half.
That's week one stuff. Yeah. That'll go away. I mean, truly, that's how this week will go. That's just the nature of it.
And nothing, the rule that everyone wants to throw a fit about, none of those flags came in. So, good progress there. What did you think of the replay calls? Because I think we saw two plays that, let's say, might have been overturned last year. The Hooper catch that might have been an incompletion, that was probably 50-50, and the Julio catch, I think last year would have been overturned and ruled a catch.
I'm with you. I like it when calls stand on the field.
Yes.
I like erring on that side, so I was fine with the replay calls tonight.
I was too. Good. Yeah. Other than that, again, I thought this poor Falcons defense, they're out there for these long drives to get worn down. I'm up here in the Northeast, and I've been running around all day telling people it's not the heat, it's the humidity. That's what gets to you. People love hearing that this time of year. I don't know. This one was we got kind of spoiled last year by the Super Bowl, and last year's opener was great too. The Chiefs-Patriots game was a...
This was a good opener. This game came down to the final play, and it was a... big long drive by both teams at the end. This was a barn burner. I don't know what you're griping about. These three games are about to preview here. We'd be so lucky if any of them are even a fraction as good as this one was.
It was a lot of flags. It was a slog. It was what? It was 26 accepted penalties and a handful of offsetting.
That's a lot. It's a lot.
It was a lot. The finish was good. That I love the Eagles' last drive. I love seeing Darren Sproles make a plays out there again. And I was into that Falcons last drive until they started just sort of lobbing the ball at the goalpost at the end of the game. But yeah. It was not as bad as people will paint this one to be, but we are going to preview some games. But first, a quick note here. You know, only with NFL Game Pass can you replay every game all season. It's NFL football anytime on your time. We just had the Eagles outlast the Falcons again, and you can get a better grasp on just how they got it done. That's because with NFL Game Pass, you can replay this game and eventually every week one game and every game all season from every angle. There's the broadcast version, commercial free. There's coaches film, which shows the all 22 angle the pros and coaches use. And there's the condensed game that lets you watch a game at about 45 minutes. So if you miss the Thursday night or you miss the Monday night or wherever it might be, that's a great way to catch up on your football the next morning. Remember, with NFL Game Pass, it's game time anytime. Best of all, you can kick off the 2018 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Sign up now at NFL.com/MMQB10things. That's MMQB10things. Game on. Andy, it's on to the traditional part of the Deep Dive Show. This is what we're going to be doing every Thursday during the season. We're going to basically deep dive preview a handful of the top games. And we're going to start with the Sunday nighter. That is Packers-Bears. And I want to start you off not with Aaron Rodgers against this Bears defense. I want to talk about the other side of the ball. We have Matt Nagy, his offense versus a Mike Pettine defense. Two new coordinators. I'm going to ask you, Andy, to go back in time to 2017, get that Chiefs offense, bring them with you back in time again to like 2011 to face that Jets defense, that Pettine Jets defense. What's the matchup here? I mean, you have the misdirection-based Bears against a Pettine defense with the Packers here. Is there a clear edge on one side of this?
It'll be interesting because Pettine believes on a lot of this stuff. Like a big part of misdirection, it was actually a big factor in this game we just talked about tonight, is just relocating receivers and tight ends from one side of the formation to the other side after the snap. And it's especially big in your running game. That really messes with linebackers and their gap responsibilities. Pettine has never been overly concerned with gap responsibilities, not in the way that most coaches are, where you got to be gap sound. This is your assignment and that's your assignment. His attitude is more get penetration, kick the crap of the guy in front of you. If you see a blocker move, go blow up the blocker, get the trash going on there, make him part of the trash on the ground, make the running back have to move and relocate. And our other defenders were rallied to the ball around that. That's the broad scope of Pettine's philosophy. Now, they're not going to be able to do that every snap. You still have to be gap sound. The Bears will stress that. But I imagine the Packers will try to combat Chicago's approach with destructiveness. Guys attacking, shooting gas. Maybe we see Ha-Ha Clinton Dix blitz from depth here, blitz from a strong safety-type position. I'm eager to see what it is because we haven't seen Mike Pettine in a few years. He was quietly working, I think, on special projects for Seattle last year, if I recall. So he's back, and it'll be interesting to watch. I would imagine they're going to fight fire with fire, though, and show a lot of moving pieces back to the Bears.
Do you think Mitch Trubisky is ready for something like that?
Oh, that I have no idea about. Trubisky is fascinating. I guess I have some idea because I'm about to answer the question. Trubisky was, I don't know what he's been in Nagy's system, I guess, is what I have no idea about. I don't know what the communication is, and I don't know how much Nagy has simplified things in a positive way for Trubisky. That's the beauty of the misdirection stuff. It looks complex, but it can be much simpler for a QB if coached properly. Trubisky on one snap last year would drop back and look like an eight-year veteran. You think, oh, my gosh, what a foundation he has. And then the very next snap, he'd look like an eight-minute rookie. And you think, my God, he's never going to learn. And he was somewhere in between, jumping all over those places last season, so which is typical of a rookie. That's to be expected. So jury's still out on him. This will be a challenge, though, because not only do you get an aggressive defense, we presume will be aggressive, but you'll get a lot of disguised and amoeba fronts. And the Bears have retooled their offensive line just a little bit, not a whole lot, I guess. But the communication with that O-line and Trubisky and deciphering those fronts, that's going to be a big deal too.
Other side of the ball, I don't want to overstate this because Aaron Rodgers is what, he's 15-4 career against Chicago. Has pretty good numbers overall, but there have been a handful of games. You go back, there was a Thanksgiving time game back in, I think it was 2015, where the Bears outlasted them. I think the it was 17-13.
Yep. Rainy game, yeah.
Yep. You know, we've seen this Bears team have some level of success against Aaron Rodgers. Do they match up well with him? And you know, setting aside, we don't know what kind of impact Khalil Mack is going to have in week one. It would be somewhat limited, I would assume. But if you take Mack out of the equation, does this Bears defense, does Vic Fangio's defense just kind of match up well with Rodgers in any way?
Yeah, it does. And here's what I've heard about Aaron Rodgers in private circles. Is he has an elephant-type memory, and he remembers every little thing that's ever gone wrong for him on a football field, and at times he'll process that. That's part of the reason he plays indecisively at times. Now, he is so good, and he's so smart that all of this, most this would usually fell a guy, but for him, it probably is an advantage in the big picture. But one of the byproducts, one of the consequences of having this great memory and remembering that, hey, 6 years ago when Baltimore showed me this look, Terrell Suggs dropped back and got in the passing lane on it, so I was worried about a zone dropper now today because I remember the Ravens doing that. When you have that kind of memory, you can overprocess information. And the Bears, with the way they use their linebackers and safeties, we talk every time we bring up the Bears, we talk about how blurry they are in Vic Fangio's scheme. Mm-hmm. A blurry defense like that against a quarterback that takes every little detail into consideration at times, that could be a bad mix. I bet Rodgers, if you got him in an honest moment, I bet he would tell you he hates playing against Vic Fangio's defense.
Now, Fangio's defense, besides Khalil Mack, you know, Roquan Smith might not be ready for much of a role in this one after a bit of an extended holdout. I don't know, you know, Trevathan and probably Kwiatkowski in the middle of that defense. Can it quite be a true Vic Fangio type of defense here when you don't have that star at linebacker?
Yes, yeah, it can, because what matters is where the linebacker lines up. So as long mm-hmm. as you have guys out there that know what they're doing, the elements that make Fangio's defense frustrating for an offense, those elements remain in play. Now, whether the Bears, I mean, they're not going to be as good doing them. You want more talented players out there, and Fangio's defense was at its best when he had Navarro Bowman and Patrick Willis at linebacker, so that matters too. But a lot of what Fangio does, it's all pre-snap. It's not all pre-snap. It's largely pre-snap stuff. Fangio does not want his defensive picture looking the same in the middle of the down as it did right before and early in the down.
And Jimmy Graham factor. We've talked about in past years, we talked about how Jared Cook added an element to this Packers offense when he was here. Martellus Bennett, during his brief stint with the Packers, sort of brought that. They would seem to have that again in Jimmy Graham, that sort of that flex tight end matchup piece in this offense. How much Aaron Rodgers seems to always be more comfortable having that piece of the offense in there. How much of a difference maker is Jimmy Graham in a matchup like this?
In my mind, Jimmy Graham's difference making will come in two ways. One will be as a backside receiver, like what Jared Cook was in those X-ISO lineups mm-hmm. for or alignments for him. That's a big deal. and that'll matter against you. Chicago plays a lot of zone coverage, so you're still going to get Graham against a cornerback there. And I know Graham's bigger, but I don't know if I love that matchup. The other thing I think Graham helps with is when plays break down or when Green Bay goes into its play extension mode, Graham presents a big body. Now, what I'm curious to see about that is, Graham had that in Seattle, too, for Russell Wilson. And I don't think, and even though his numbers actually were not a whole lot dissimilar in Seattle as they were in New Orleans, just watching the feel of the offense and Jimmy Graham's role within it, I think Graham was better with the Saints, which are a highly structured offense. Almost nothing ever breaks down in the Saints system. So I think Graham's skill set is fine when things break down and it matches with Rodgers, but his history suggests maybe it won't be. So I'm interested to see how it goes because of the dichotomy in Jimmy Graham.
Do you anticipate, I'm going to ask you to make a wild guess here, Andy, and I'm sorry for that. The Packers are obviously, they finally moved on from Dom Capers on the other side of the ball. Do you anticipate something a little more structured, maybe some more man-beater concepts with what they're doing on offense here after all these years of basically doing the same thing year in and year out?
No, I don't. They might try it a little bit here and there. Ultimately, though, we say it all the time, your offense becomes what your quarterback is. It takes the shape of your quarterback. And Rodgers is more comfortable sorting things out after the snap than before the snap. And man beaters are not necessarily conducive to that. ISO routes tend to be more conducive to that. And not just ISO routes, but spread routes. It's called spread formations. So the Bears, it's a fine line for Mike McCarthy to walk and Joe Philbin back at offensive coordinator. I'm sure they've had a lot of discussions about this. Mm-hmm. And it'll be the Bears, I think that game you mentioned that it was a Thanksgiving night game, the rainy night.
Thanksgiving night.
Yeah, because they retired Favre's jersey that night or whatever. They did some kind of big Brett Favre thing. The Bears, if I recall, they played a lot of man coverage in that game, and there have been other times that they have done that because Green Bay does struggle so much against man-to-man. But the Bears' forte is zone. And an interesting question that I'd love to ask a game planner sometime is, in week one, are you more inclined to go with your forte rather than cater the game plan to your opponent, even if it's a divisional opponent, because you've just spent months and months practicing your forte all of training camp? And I don't know the answer to that. If I had to guess, I bet the Bears will stick with their forte and be a straight zone defense in this game.
Interesting. Even with basically the same guys back from last year?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought about adding that part in too. That's the little bit of the wild card is that Fangio doesn't have to acclimate a lot of guys. It's the same lineup basically. So yeah, if they want to get more expansive, they can. And that now we're getting into the discussion of how do you get a player in rhythm? How do you get them comfortable? And that's something coaches have to figure out in their game plan and then within their game plan. I was watching film with Bill Sheridan earlier this offseason, and he's now the Boston College linebackers coach. He was with Detroit last year, and he by the way, is the best teacher I've encountered for defensive stuff, I think, the way he explains the game. He is very academic in his explanation and very deliberate with his words. He is a great coach. And one of the things he explained is, like, there were a few plays where they didn't have great answers for what the offensive look was. And he said, we were just trying to settle our guys down and put them in familiar positions and get them playing football, get them into their football mindset. And I wonder if that was an example for one or two plays that we were watching, but I bet you could expand that example and apply it to a game, week one and week two. Hey, it's opening night. It's going to be on national TV. It's a rivalry game. You're in Lambeau Field. Let's do what makes us comfortable, and at least we can trust that we'll play as fast as possible that way.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to see exactly what the Bears can do here. We'll see what Khalil Mack, what kind of role he has. We'll see what Roquan Smith does. Bears are in a weird spot. I don't want to project forward for the season on this show, obviously, but I feel like they have an offense that would catch some people off guard early, but I think the defense is not quite where it's going to be, so I think they might be sort of caught in between here. I don't know. Cowboys-Panthers, Andy. And we should note, the MMQB Gambling Podcast also comes out on Friday. It is still going to come out on Friday. It's just going to come out a little bit later to create some space between these two episodes. You need to look for that. I don't know, probably around noon Eastern time here on Friday here. Cowboys-Panthers, Andy. Look, Dallas, they're short on weapons in the passing game. It's all going to be on that that ground game, what they're going to be able to do offensively this year. Taking out the Travis Frederick factor, just conceptually, this elite outside zone running game against this Panthers defense where you have Kuechly and you have these fast linebackers, that would seem to be a difficult matchup for the Cowboys. Not you know, they match up well with everyone because they're so good up front, but it would seem like a tougher matchup.
I would agree. I think every coach would agree, too. Carolina's a hard defense to run outside against because of those linebackers and because of some penetrating D tackles they have. Guys like Kawan Short, we'll see if Butler can become a more consistent factor in that regard. Yeah, it's a hard defense to run against. One thing you can do, though, is Carolina will stay in their base 4-3 no matter what you put on the field in your running game. So if you want to go two tight ends, two full, or a fullback and a running back, 22 personnel, or three tight ends, and go back to that goal line stuff we talked about earlier from the Falcons-Eagles, Carolina's going to stay in their base 4-3. So you can overpower those guys. And they also, the Panthers, tend to be a little bit predictable out of that sometimes. So the way to attack Carolina, if you're insisting on running the ball against them, the way to attack them is to run right at them.
Do you think Dallas does that, minus Travis Frederick? I mean, is that a realistic attack in this game?
Well, yeah, because you still got to play. You still have to play. And Frederick's – who's taken Frederick's place? Has that been completely decided?
That's actually a great question. Probably should have researched that before the show, but – now that we have it looks like
I got my guy Jackson Magnini, he's got the best depth charts, and he just sent me his new ones today. I didn't watch Dallas's last couple preseason games. I am looking up now. I bet it's Looney, if I had
Joe
to guess.
Looney.
Yeah. And Jackson's got Frederick in italics here as a first string guy, so that means something Jackson to him. I don't know what it means to me. Joe Looney is their backup center. Just going off the depth chart. Anyway, you still got to play with let's say it's Joe Looney in there. Looney, or whoever it is not going to be as good of an outside zone blocker as Frederick is, but you still got to run the ball. So that's all the more reason to just ram it up inside, because every NFL center knows how to hike the ball and then go block the guy that's 6 inches in front of him.
All right.
Block him
fair
north
enough
and south. Yeah.
Fair enough. You know, this Panther secondary would seem to be obviously the weak point of this defense still. James Bradbury's coming on, but you know, that is not what they invest in. Can the Cowboys? I don't know. You just look at this receiving group and these tight ends. Do you expect the Cowboys to be able to get anything going in this passing game?
If they scheme it, they can, and you know what Carolina is going to be in a lot of their coverages. They're a pretty straightforward zone team, so that's all the more opportunity to scheme. When you know what the coverage will be, you can game plan accordingly. If they just line up and play like they did last year, it's not going to work. And
I was gonna say,
remember,
they don't scheme it very often. That's
you're
not
right.
Really
they do not. They do not. This wide receiving core, you could argue it's better than last year's. Last year's, we forget how bad it was because Dez Bryant's a known name, and so we talked about him every week. But Dez Bryant couldn't play anymore. That's why he's out of the league now. So it's not that they've downgraded here. They've made changes, and there's reason to believe. I'd take Allen Hurns over Dez Bryant in a heartbeat at this stage of each guy's career. So it's a better receiving core than a year ago. The Jason Witten factor is a big one, though. That's the X factor. As Witten was a security blanket. They don't have that now. I would probably not expect a lot of balls thrown to the tight ends, especially because that's Luke Kuechly, Thomas Davis territory. Kuechly is the best pass-defending linebacker in football.
other side of the ball here. Do you have any sense of what a Norv Turner offense will look like after Norv had basically a year and a half out of football to come up with some things? And obviously he has two very unique players in Cam Newton and Christian McCaffrey to build this offensive around.
Yeah, and he needs to leverage those guys. It's funny because Norv Turner stepped away from football for a while when Minnesota's offensive line got ravaged by injuries. Turner's scheme was not conducive to hiding an O-line so much. Turner prefers deep dropbacks. He's at times in his career, he's been willing to live with mismatches in the pass protection game. He thinks he can get away with that, and he probably does more often than not. Otherwise, he wouldn't be doing it for so many years. But the weakness in Minnesota that year, the 2016, their tackles were so depleted that it was too much to overcome. And they had to change a scheme, and so they changed coordinators. Well, here's Turner back in the NFL now, and Matt Khalil at left tackle's gone out, injured. He'll be gone for a while. Darrell Williams has not been healthy. I'd be surprised if he plays this week, but there's both of your tackles, and they're already weaker at guard than they were a year ago.
Yeah.
A lot of ugly questions with this Panthers O-line, and that can be hard to hide multiple O-line weaknesses. So I don't know what Turner's offense will look like. I am fascinated, too, because I want to know what it's going to look like in the running game, too. He has to use Cam Newton just as much as the previous regime did. We'll see if he does. We've never seen him with a QB like Newton as a mobile factor.
Yeah. Do you worry about the Cowboys up the middle here? I mean, a lot of noise. They were trying to get Earl Thomas in here. Xavier Woods is dealing with some hamstring stuff. Leighton Vander Esch, your neighbor, had all kinds of injury issues this summer, and it seems like he's going to be behind going into the season here. Sean Lee is Sean Lee, but do you worry that they are maybe panicking a little bit with how they're going to get this thing set up the middle of the defense?
Well, first of all, since you brought up the neighborly thing, because Leighton Vander Esch, when we did that thing, he did visit my home. He picked me up, and we drove up to Riggins, Idaho, from Boise. And
yeah.
I thought, like, oh, my goodness, my two little dogs who have the courage of a footstool, they're going to lose their crap here because this is the biggest guy, and he's going to have that alpha male vibe to him, and it's going to intimidate him. My dogs did great with Leighton Vander Esch. He was very, very friendly and gentle to him. So it just seems like a neighborly thing. That's what made me think of that.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm worried about his soft tissue stuff. That can be a big deal. That can be hard to combat, and it's kept him out for a while. I think I'm going to take the optimistic side of this, Gary, because if I recall, a few months ago, I was the one that said, why are you writing off Jalen Smith? He's coming off of the most atrocious knee injury, one of them, that we've ever seen. And I thought there were some decent signs last year, and you basically said, no, Jalen Smith is garbage, and they ought to draft Leighton Vander Esch. And here we are. Jalen Smith, I think, beat out Leighton Vander Esch. I don't know if Vander Esch had been healthy, Smith still might be starting next to Sean Lee in their nickel base.
Yeah, well, we'll see about that. I don't think Jalen Smith is garbage, Andy.
Pretty sure you said garbage.
I don't think I did. I didn't, did I? I didn't say anyone's garbage. They can all destroy me with their bare hands. I'm very careful with what I say about people who are bigger than me. That's why I'm so complimentary of everyone on this show. Oh, I don't think we answered that last question, but that's okay. Let's go on to Niners-Vikings here. I mean, look, this is Kyle Shanahan offense versus Mike Zimmer D. Is there less of an advantage for Shanahan? This is a little bit silly, but especially going against a Vikings D that has, you have safeties, you have Eric Kendricks, an athletic linebacker. Basically, the way Shanahan's going to use these backs and tight ends, do the Vikings just match up especially well with what Kyle Shanahan would usually use to exploit a defense?
The Vikings at this point match up well to just about anything because they have probably the NFC's best D-line, certainly the NFC's best secondary. They might have the NFC's best linebacking unit. I mean, you could make that argument, even though I would argue Jalen Smith with the Cowboys makes that the best linebacking unit. And they've been in that scheme all together now, like as a group, for I think they're entering year number five now under Mike Zimmer. So they're going to match up fine because they're going to do what they do. And they do what they do very well, and it's also it can be hard to play against. We think of Minnesota as this aggressive blitzing defense because that's what Mike Zimmer was years ago. He was a pioneer in the double A gap stuff, but that's really not how they play. They line up in double A gap, but they don't bring a whole lot of pressure. They keep their guys back, and they make you beat all of their defenders downfield and really earn your yards. Shanahan, look, he knows what he's going to get because it's a zone defense. He knows where the defenders will be in zone. He knows their rules out of zone coverage, I'm sure, by now. And so he'll have the chance to exploit it. And I'm a big believer in scheme, as you know, Gary, and especially Shanahan's scheme. But players still win games. And Minnesota has a lot of better players than San Francisco. And that's going to mean something in this game.
How much you worry about? I know we talked about this last week, but I do want to prod you on this again. The Jerick McKinnon injury. We discussed this on the gambling show, which you can hear later today. But essentially, Shanahan was so pumped up for McKinnon, and he was probably designing some things for Jerick McKinnon. And now McKinnon's out of it, and it's like, It really throws a wrench into things at this point.
Oh, he wasn't designing things for McKinnon. He was designing things around McKinnon. McKinnon would have been the backbone of the offense. Let's pretend that the quarterback can't be the backbone. We're talking about the movable chess pieces. Mm-hmm. Who's your big movable piece? Who's the queen on your chessboard? McKinnon would have been the queen on the chessboard. And Shanahan even admitted that. He said this injury, this changes things pretty drastically, was his quote, pretty drastically. That's a big admission from a head coach heading into a week one game, especially with an injured guy. They're going to miss him because they need that flexibility in the passing game from the running back position, and I don't think they've got anyone else on the roster that at this point they feel can provide even a good chunk of what McKinnon would have provided.
Yeah. Plus, it would have been a revenge game for McKinnon.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier in my, because I'm doing the game-by-game previews now for our Friday column. And my first sentence of the Niners-Vikings, which I eventually deleted, was like, this was supposed to be the Jerick McKinnon Bowl. And just seeing the words Jerick McKinnon Bowl, I thought I couldn't tell if I was being sarcastic or not. It was my sentence. And I thought, can it be a revenge game if you were a backup running back and you got paid probably three times more by someone else? I mean, it's I don't know. I don't know what the revenge would be.
I call everything a revenge game, but I love the idea of the Jerick McKinnon Bowl because I really the college bowl season, I really don't think you're very far away from a Jerick McKinnon Bowl.
No, yeah,
because they have a bowl named after everything else.
Yeah, right, exactly. He sends in a donation to somewhere and buys the uniform patches that you put on the shoulders of the players in the bowl game. And then gets someone a big shiny glass trophy that looks like all the 10,000 other glass trophies from bowl games. And, yeah, you have a very nice Jerick McKinnon Bowl there.
I cannot wait to see UAB and Akron in the Jerick
McKinnon
Bowl.
Yeah, I was just trying to think.
2024.
Who would face off with who there? Yeah, I'm with you.
Other side of the ball real quick. All the attention is going to be on the quarterbacks in this game and anything left over is going to the Vikings defense. Where's this 49ers defense in your mind at this point? It seems like they're a work in progress. I mean, to me, this is why I'm not terribly bullish on the 49ers as a Super Bowl contender. Obviously they're a playoff contender at this point, is this defense ready for the next step, or in your mind, is it going to be another year or two for them?
So let's talk immediate future. They got some questions at linebacker because Reuben Foster is serving his timeout for his highly active offseason. Mm-hmm. They're not deep at corner at all. They're not deep at particularly deep at safety. So questions in the secondary, well, do we have a good enough pass rush to overcome our back seven limitations? And that's, we'll find out. They need Eric Armstead to become a quality edge rusher, and that's really not how he's built to play. That's not his body type. That's not his history. They even know, Robert Saleh told me that on the record this year when I met with him in his office, Niners D coordinator. So I think they're short a pass rusher here, Gary, to be honest. I think Solomon Thomas will have a nice second season. You know how I feel about DeForest Buckner, dark horse defensive player of the year guy, but he probably won't get it because the rest of the defense around him is not very good, and if they don't, you know, it's going to be hard for him to stand out.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the problem we've talked about for what, like 18 months now since they drafted Solomon Thomas. They kind of have three really good players in Thomas, DeForest Buckner, obviously, and Armstead. But they all kind of, they're a little bit redundant.
Yeah, they are a little bit redundant. And the hard part is figuring out just where to play them. Never pass up talent, or I guess don't never say never, but you know, they drafted talent. They got good physical specimens here. They need to figure out how to use them. Buckner is a good fit. There's nothing to worry about there. I think Thomas will be a good fit as a first and second down defensive end and then a third down D tackle. It's what he was at Stanford. So they're rock solid inside. They're no different than the Rams. Theoretically, they've got two great D tackles that they love in passing situations. It's what they have on the outside that will be the key, which also makes them no different than the Rams. We've talked about the Rams edge rushers this year.
Yeah. Yeah, and Foster out. Looks like rookie Fred Warner is going to get the start there at linebacker, who I always found fascinating at BYU. He was an interesting prospect to me as sort of a size speed guy with good instincts, but he's kind of he's almost like a oversized safety more than a linebacker. So this will be an interesting welcome to the NFL moment for him here. One more game, and I don't want to. We'll lightning roundish this one, Andy, but actually lightning round it. I had two quick questions about the Giants Jaguars. I think the matchup everyone's going to be talking about all weekend is Odell Beckham Jr. versus Jalen Ramsey. Based on how Pat Shurmur used his receivers in Minnesota last year, would you expect Beckham to spend a lot of time in the slot? And we talked about this. The Jaguars are thin at cornerback. They lost Aaron Colvin. They really don't have that slot corner anymore. That's going to be a weak spot for this defense. Are we going to see Beckham in the slot? When we do see Beckham in the slot, would you expect Ramsey to follow him or even A.J. Bouye to follow him?
Depends what down. If it's first and second down, they would not follow him because Jacksonville is going to stay committed to their cover three zone in those situations. Third down, they might be more inclined to travel and play man-to-man. We'll see. If I were Pat Shurmur, I'd go out and put Beckham in the slot early, and I'd try to get him two or three catches, one of them explosive, downfield, big throw, and avoid the Ramsey matchup initially so that Beckham can get his touches, get comfortable, and get in the flow of the game. That way you don't run the risk of having another Josh Norman situation where Beckham starts out cold, has a bad drop, and then Norman easily gets inside his head and all embarrassment breaks out. And that can happen here. That Jalen Ramsey did that to A.J. Green last year. So I would be a little worried about this matchup from the Giants' standpoint just based on both Ramsey's and Beckham's history. And maybe Beckham is mellowed now. He's a little bit older. He's now been paid. He's been validated. I'd love to see him mature because of that. We'll find out. But let's find out after we get Beckham comfortable. Let's make it easier on him, too. Yeah. It's easier to be mature when you've got three catches for 70 yards in the first half versus one for 12 yards.
I will say, I mean, he knows it's coming. Like this, he's had like weeks to sort of steel himself for the Jalen Ramsey experience, and Jalen Ramsey is going to tell him all about how he's going to be a great hockey player or whatever Jalen Ramsey talks about now. I do want to talk about the other side of the ball in this game. The Giants have issues with the pass rush. The secondary, you know, we've talked about it. The secondary could kind of go either way. You can see the talent there. Obviously, they had some issues last year. But the Jaguars are you know, they want to run the ball. They want to run the ball on the interior. They brought in Andrew Norwell. They figured to be even better in the run game this year. That seems to be where the Giants' strength is with Damon Harrison in the middle of that defensive line. Is this going to have to be something of a Blake Bortles game for the Jaguars?
Yeah, it probably will, because I bet you, here's what James Betcher, the Giants' new D coordinator, I bet here's what he did when he went into his office this week or probably a few weeks ago and started getting ready for this game. He put on the Jaguars film and he saw, oh, A-gap run. Oh, B-gap run. Oh, a couple more A-gap runs. We talked it last year, Gary. We don't see a lot of A-gap runs in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Most runs tend to have some texture to them. This was hand off and hit it. Hand off and hit it. Well, what Betcher likes to do against most teams, and I'm sure he would love to do it against a team that's going to try to just ram the ball truly right down the middle of the D, he condenses his fronts. He brings his defensive linemen and puts them tight inside, and he'll line up three defensive tackles right over the center and two guards. It's a jam front. So you do that, you're not running against that. It doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter. I don't want to say it doesn't matter who's playing defense, but you're not running against Damon Harrison in a jam front.
Yeah.
So the Jags will have to do something. They'll have to be a little creative in the running game. The guy I'm interested to see with Jacksonville, a lot of my researchers have been discouraging me from this because they're big on TJ Yeldon, who I was bigger on than anybody in the history of the world a few years ago. But Corey Grant, who played last year in the AFC Championship, they've had him in a two-back set. Forget if it was Fournette or if it was Yeldon out there with him, but it was Grant and one other running back. He's a shifty, dynamic receiving back, and he brought some real unique dimension to the offense as a slashing receiver out of the backfield, and then I think some speed stuff, the ball concepts that get him the ball on the perimeter. That could be a good tactic against the Giants, because I don't think you're running inside against this team.
That's Corey Grant. Every time someone mentions Corey Grant, he was a pure analytics team guy when the Jaguars drafted him. It's Shad Khan's, and this is going to be very rude of me. I can't remember Shad Khan's son's name off the top of my head.
Tony Khan.
Tony Khan? There we go. Thank you, Andy. You know it all. He gets to put together a list of undrafted free agents he wants to bring in based solely on basically the numbers crunching of you know, the various measurements and that sort of thing. And Corey Grant was one of those guys, one of the success stories from that. So that's my Corey Grant story.
that's a good one. I like that. That's a nice twist.
Was it really, Andy?
Tony Khan's very likable, so anytime we can mention him, I'm all for it. Remember his dance that they caught him doing in the playoff game last year? This little shimmy dance, a delightful dance up in the press box next to a stoic Tom Coughlin. Well, Google it. Tom Coughlin sitting there straight ahead, looking straight ahead, very Tom Coughlin-ish, and then Tony Khan can't help but get out of his chair and dance a little bit. It was just pure joy.
That's pretty good. That's a good way to wrap this show. A little bit of someone explaining dancing to another person. That's how we wrap most of our shows now. I can't imagine it's the first time you ever heard the show, if you're listening this deep into it, but this is the top of the show when we recap that Falcons-Eagles game. That's what we do most Monday mornings. We do the previews on Thursdays. That's the deep dive show. We will be back with the full week 1 recap of Sunday's games. We'll be in your feed Monday morning, so please subscribe now. I do want to take a quick moment to thank, we thank him every week, but we especially want to thank Shelby Royston, our producer for Cadence 13. He stayed up late with us tonight. Andy and I if I could pull back the curtain for a moment, we can tape the show from our respective homes. Shelby actually has to go to the studio and do this stuff. And I'm keeping him up even later with this thank you. So thank you to Shelby. He'll be with us all season. He is literally, he makes this show go. We talk, and Shelby actually puts the thing out to the world for people to hear us talk, so we are very thankful for him. We also thank today's sponsor, that is NFL Game Pass. Without them, they wouldn't let us do the show, so please support them the way they support us. Again, look, we... Andy and I are both Game Pass users a long time. Go NFL.com/MMQB10things and get your 7-day free trial. We strongly recommend it if you like this kind of stuff, and I'm guessing you do. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this very special episode of the MMQB Deep Dive NFL Podcast. You really are the best. We will have mini mailbags on this Thursday show during the year, so send in those questions. Talk back at themmqb.com is probably the best way. Just put podcast in the subject line. We will find it. You can also get Andy and I on Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI. We are also both on Facebook. You can get us there too. Remember to listen and subscribe to all the MMQB NFL podcasts. We're all on one feed now. You get Albert Breer on Wednesday with he's doing a show with Connor Orr and Jenny Brentis now. And you get the MMQB Gambling Podcast every Friday if you're into that sort of thing. We talk some pretty good football too. It's myself, my brother Scott Grambling of the he's managing editor of DRF Daily Racing Forum Sports Forum, and Jimmy Traina of the SI Media Podcast. That's it for this one. Subscribe to the MMQB Podcast, the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.